And thanks again to everyone who's read, helped us open the meeting. Welcome to those that have joined us since we first started. Glad you're here. Good to see you. Okay, so we are a speaker meeting, and it is falling on me this evening to introduce our speaker. I met this gentleman fairly recently, actually, at the London Convention. I'm always struck sometimes I meet people in the course of the journey that we're all on and feel an instant connection, and did with this particular person. I just feel as though there's something there, you know what I mean? And he's a very good friend of an old friend of mine who I've known in recovery for a long time. We had some great conversations about stuff. I do know that he's one of the individuals that embraced the online stuff at the beginning of the pandemic. He's done amazing stuff in the area that he's in with that. And it's just a real pleasure to have seen that happening and growing and doing what it's done. I'm sure he has don't know him at all, really. I'm sure he has an absolutely fascinating story to tell us. So he's come along today to share his experience, friends, and hope with us for 40 or 45 minutes, whatever he's comfortable with. His journey through Narcotics Anonymous. So, Paul, the floor is yours. Please share with us. Thank you.
Thank you, Steve. Hi, guys. My name is Paul, and I'm an addict.
Hey, Paul.
Hi, Paul.
Welcome.
Thank you for the warm welcome. I was having a bit of a feeling there when Steve was talking, because somebody said to me, you know, you never know who you're inspiring, you know, and I really kind of, we as an area, in fact, East Coast Scotland, looked at Hignor and the stuff you were doing and the, you know, audio online before we were in the pandemic. And, you know, you guys have been trailblazers, you know, you really have. And I love that kind of attitude of open-mindedness around the program and how we can keep this stuff newcomer focused where we need to be. It says in the literature, doesn't it? It says we have to keep our meetings newcomer focused. And I think, you know, Steve and the team, the way you guys go about it, even watching from afar, it leaves me in no doubt that everything you are doing is designed to reach the still suffering addict. You know, and I mean, without going in, that's not all you're doing. Obviously, you're connecting people, the Highlands and Islands thing, people who can't get to meetings as easily. You know, you guys had a vision, and it's been very inspiring for us, you know, and we're kind of, we in the East Coast Scotland have got kind of you to thank for the maybe some of the innovations we've done. You know, it's been tough. I'm sure you've come up against it, Steve. It's the process of being innovative and maybe using some of these platforms and using some of these tools, whether it's social media, public relations. That's my background, by the way, journalism and public relations. I'll hopefully get into that. Using these tools, you know, we can come up against it, you know. And Steve was just asking me at the start of the meeting, what's your clean time, Paul, for the start, for the when you post the recording of this year, we put the clean time, and it's the 27th of March 2020. And here's another evolution. We've got a clean time app these days, haven't we? So I could tell you exactly 771 days is what I've got today, which for me is, you know, I still look at that app, and I still look at how many days have I got today. Wow, I'm going to be 770 days. Wow, seven, seven, seven. You know, I just, these numbers all mean something to me, because my clean time means something to me. And I think I was just very, very fortunate. You know, I'm not one of these. I was introduced to NA in 2005. So, you know, I do spend a lot of time pondering why it worked for me this time, why it works for me just for today, why I do the things I do, and why I was doing a lot of these things before but couldn't stay clean. I've still not really found an answer to that, but I could maybe explore some of those questions. So I'm working for I maybe won't say the newspaper, but I'm a political journalist in London in Fleet Street, working for a national newspaper. And I think, it was what I was trying to do. I was using through a lot of my career, but I think I got to that point where I was so in such denial and so disconnected from the reality of things that I thought I could integrate the drugs into my career, my home, my marriage, my home life. And I was leading a very hedonistic lifestyle. That's how my dad always describes it to me. I think it was a bit more than that, but it meant that wherever I was traveling in the world, because I was with a group of journalists who would travel with the Prime Minister. At that time, I think it was Tony Blair, then it was Gordon Brown. But so I'd be going to hot. I tell you, if I'd be in the Ukraine right now, I'd be looking for drugs in the Ukraine. So if it was in Shanghai, if I was in St. Petersburg, even Baghdad, I'd be hunting out the translators and looking for ways and means, and that was crazy. I remember, I suppose all that shame, really kind of kept me using, the Jekyll and Hyde analogy, the Deacon Brodie story that's in the basic text, and the Jekyll and Hyde was based on a guy, a real guy called Deacon Brodie, who was a cabinet maker and councillor in Edinburgh, and he was leading this double life where he was, highly respected in his community, but he was, I don't know what the drug of choice was. I think it was gambling. And he was breaking into his clients' houses, and it was the biggest public execution in Edinburgh at the time. I think we're talking about the 1700s. And I can really identify with that, the double life. I'm sure a lot of people knew I was using because I was in, I was half sharp knife. But in my head, I was still kind of operating at quite a high level. Maybe people were sort of apprehensive in confronting me. So yeah, I shared this story. It's funny. I heard a girl sharing in a meeting that she'd gone to the doctor, and she didn't want to say she was using whatever drug she was using, street drugs. And she'd said to the doctor, every time I drink, I can't stop drinking, and every time I drink, I end up what she described as the whole straw. I end up selling myself to get more. And the doctor was, "What? You do what?" And she felt such that deep sense of shame. And she said, when I came into an NA meeting, I said to them, "Look, I can't stop using, and every time I use, I sell myself." And the whole meeting erupted, and yeah, everyone's cheering with identification. And I had a similar experience when I talked about smuggling drugs on the Prime Minister's plane. And I had to take these drugs. I was going to withdraw, and I smuggled them on. And we had very little in the way of security when you're traveling with the Prime Minister. When he's in the air, they call the plane VIP1, which means it gets priority over all other planes in the sky. And security was very light, and I would take drugs with me. And when I shared that in the meeting, I once smuggled heroin onto Tony Blair's plane. The whole meeting, like, it started cheering, and it's just great. It just tells me about this kind of atmosphere of confidence that I have in these meetings, where I can share that kind of stuff, and someone maybe identifies, and we can share with each other, and we can keep that atmosphere of recovery. So, 2005, the newspaper have pulled me aside. I'm looking like a Belsen concentration camp victim. And they're saying, "Look, you can admit this, or and we put you into treatment, or we can sack you." And it was one of these kind of London celebrity treatment centres, kind of 12-step, but not really. Obviously, I wasn't ready either. But the great thing was, when I was finally getting kicked out of there, for the kinds of things that you get kicked out of treatment for, a girl said, "Have you heard of Narcotics Anonymous?" And I No, never heard of it. Phone this guy. Ironically, Steve, I hadn't seen that guy since my first meeting, and I met him at the London Convention there just a few weeks ago, which was really moving. Excuse me. And yeah, this guy took me to my first meeting, St. Catherine Cree in the City of London, you know. And you know what struck me was that at that first meeting, even though I couldn't go anywhere at that point without having my various tools of the trade on me, you know, because I needed to be using 24/7. I was really struck by the unconditional love. The unconditional love, the love that we experienced in these rooms penetrated the drugs and stayed with me until I was ready to come back, you know, because I felt the solution in that room at my first meeting. So when I was finally ready, even though I've gone through my ups and downs in NA and feeling resentful towards NA and blaming all you guys and blaming this member for doing this, and that's why I'm, you know, even though I've gone through that, when I was beaten and ready to give it another go, I knew exactly where to come back to, and that came from my very first meeting in 2005. So there you go, 15 years of getting progressively worse, 15 years of geographicals. Once I completely rinsed London and, you know, probably wasn't going to get another job in London again, I did a geographical move to Singapore, did the expat thing in Singapore for a year, got a job, and then it all kicked off again. And Singapore is one of those countries that I couldn't go back to even if I wanted to. So, yeah, it was just wherever I went, it followed me. And I think I just repeated this pattern. And it was, you know, I was labouring under the misapprehension that if I got a few days clean or got on an opiate replacement program or whatever it was, some kind of substitute, that I could and got a job and got a job and pulled my socks up and knuckled down. That and a girlfriend and this and that, some external thing to fix me, that I could beat this thing on my own. Because you know what, when you come from the media world, self-will's an asset, you know. Stabbing people in the back is an asset. It's a very kind of tough world, and taking people's inventory is an asset, you know. And I've been doing this stuff since leaving school, you know. And I become very adept. And I really, when I came, had to let go of all of those ideas. I really had to change everything, you know. It's been a big job the last couple of years. A lot of work's had to go into it. So yeah, I'm not one of those using addicts that stays away from meetings, you know. And it was face-to-face meetings then, and I'm turning up with, you know, I've gone. Was I homeless? I was kind of sleeping on people's sofas. I was sleeping on park benches. I was sleeping on stairwells. You know, the last, you know, this whole idea about me finding work. I've returned from Singapore and I'm in and out of work. And of course, it's a very small industry, so people talk, but you always think that you're going to be able to con someone into looking at your pretty good skill set and your experience. Sorry, so much of this is focused on my career. I'm just trying to illustrate that in my mind, I thought I was a functioning addict, and I thought I was the consummate con man, you know. And I'd convinced, when was this now? Let me see. I'm back a couple of years, and I'm using, and then I'm not using, and I'm on this script, and I'm off this script, and I'm trying to find a job to fix me. And I get a job with the Mayor of Manchester as his head of communications, and it's running a team of about 30, and it's running all the stuff that we do: social media marketing, media releases. It's a very high profile figure, so we were doing stuff every single day. We were running campaigns because there's a huge homeless problem in Manchester. It was very full on. You know, and I was probably like a few days clean when I landed there. And what I'd completely forgotten when I'd gone through my interview process and I'd been hired was that I had about five or six drugs charges outstanding in the courts in Aberdeen, which were going to come to some kind of negative fruition for me. I just blanked all of that out. I blanked out all of that out. So what happened was, I'm working for this guy for about 6 weeks. I'm using like an absolute demon, acting like a serpent, and it's getting worse. I mean, I'm going like it was so schizophrenic. You know, on one hand, I've got this huge team and this huge responsibility, and at lunch, every lunchtime, I'm out and sort of, you know, injecting myself or smoking this or doing something in some back street corner. Literally, you know, that's the way they use in somewhere like Manchester. It's very front line, and it's like trying to find a vein under a street lamp or in a phone box. You know, it was like that. You know, it was so, because that's what I'd been doing before I arrived in Manchester. So fast forward 6 weeks, and my drug case has finally reached the court in Aberdeen. And the next thing is, the newspapers in Aberdeen are phoning the office that I'm in charge of, the media office, to ask one of my team if the mayor has a comment on the fact that his head of communications has just been convicted in the courts for possession of blah blah blah. And it's just like, I tell you, a moment like that tends to, does it strip away the denial? Probably did for about 30 seconds, as they said, "Is this you? Is this actually you?" I'm like, "Yeah, well, it is." And I'm thinking, what lie can I pull out here? What lie can I actually say? Oh, well, it wasn't me. I had a girlfriend and she was into drugs, and I was doing the very gallant thing of taking the hit for her. And they were like, "Look, just get out. Just, you're just so full of shit. Get out." And yeah, that probably kind of, in that moment, it suited me, because what did I do? If I think about it now, I headed straight to the high rise where all my connections were, and with some money in my pocket, and I just used as much as I could to blank out the horror of what had happened. And then I've got to come back to Aberdeen, of course, and face the music, you know. And when I come out the court, because they've asked for me to appear in person, you know, I've got about, I don't know, a dozen photographers and cameras in my face, because it's a high profile position. They're interested in this story, and that kind of stuff can keep you using, you know, that level of shame. You know, when you're splashed across Google and you're splashed across the newspapers that you used to work for, it's a whole new level. It was for me. It was a whole new level. But when you've been in Google, you know, it does strip away a bit of the denial. And I think I probably used for another couple of months after that. And we were into pandemic, you know, so I seized my chance to do a detox. And I'm going into all this kind of detail. I hope you don't mind, because it's very rare that we get a chance to share for 40 minutes. So I will get into program. I hope this isn't too boring. But the fact of the matter is, I knew where to come back to, and I came back to NA, and I still had people here that I knew. You know, most of the people who were getting clean around 2005 were still clean up here. You know, multiple black key rings. You know, when I got my black key ring here finally, it was like, that wasn't even on the, you know, that was unobtainable. That was a dream. That was something I could never attain. So yes, the what happened? So we come in here, and I just throw myself at it 24/7. First thing is, Paul, you've got to stay out of work. There's no like, get 6 months clean and then start. Like, who would employ me anyway, other than, you know, I'm certainly not going to go back right back into what I was doing before. I've still got to overcome all that. The explanation, you know, I've still got to discover myself anyway. I've got no idea who I am. My ego's large and dominant. I'm a completely false construct of all these ideas, false ideas, fear. You know, there's something in the literature when it says, when you strip back the disease of addiction, you just find a swamp of self-centered fear. So it's interesting. I kind of had this notion early on that I would take all my natural passion, and ability, and I wasn't a bad guy, you know. I wasn't a stupid guy. I just did stupid things, you know, and I would take all of that energy and I would put it into something positive. The friend of mine who Steve referred to in the introduction talks about it, because we talk almost every day and we have done since I came back. He talks about it about as installing a new program. He talks about it as we need to brainwash ourselves, you know. So, and I heard somebody else talking about it, said, Paul, get habits and rituals that are serving you instead of destroying you, and all of the things that all of those things that made me so good at my job and also made me such a resourceful using addict. I would now turn into, I would now put it into any and put it into the program. So, and a lot of that, Steve, you know, looked like service. If I can just circle back to what we were talking about in the beginning, we're on this exciting new platform. In our case, it's Zoom, obviously, we're not affiliated. And I'm throwing myself into service, and I'm throwing myself into step work, very detailed step work. You know, I only mention this because it's relevant. And I'm now trying to figure out these principles, you know, this set of principles that are written so simply that we can follow them in our daily lives. And I'm finding that as I'm doing written step work, which for me is a bit of a joy, because I've got so much baggage to unpack, because as you've heard, I'm carrying all this bloody guilt and shame, and that's only in recent years. And I've got to unpack it in the step work. Number two, I'm finding out that there are these things called spiritual principles, which are embedded in the step work, and it served me. But you know, I'm not quite equipped to do the kind of service that I was doing. I had no self-acceptance, right? So what I'm wanting to do is come in, put down the drugs, and present to you like the perfect addict. Look at Paul, look at all the service. Oh, he's doing regional service now. He's doing these great public relations projects. He's doing this. He's doing, I didn't stop, you know. And there's a lot of positives in some of those stories. But for me, it was bittersweet because there was a lot of negatives. I don't regret some of the stuff that happened, because it allowed me to really practice principles. It also... I also started to learn about boundaries. I also started to learn that, you know, when I needed help, to ask for it, and when I was harming myself, you know, just like the drugs, when I was harming myself by going to a particular meeting where I was just sitting taking everyone's inventory, I had to do what it tells me in the steps, you know, abstain, make a decision, and apply a principle, you know. And yeah, I had quite a negative experience with my first sponsorship. You know, I think it's incredible, the gift of sponsorship. It says in the literature that it's a two-way, it's a give and take, not two-way, it's a give and take partnership, right? So I'm starting to feel like there's a hierarchy here in NA, and it's partly created in my own mind, and I think it's just the way it's kind of been passed down. And first of all, I started to notice it in the service structure, which I think is supposed to be an inverted pyramid with the members and the groups at the top, but it didn't feel like that to me. But then part of me thinks, well, Paul, you're still crazy, you're still full of resentment, you're really angry. In fact, it's really hard for me to identify my feelings. This was before I was doing daily inventory. So we did some amazing stuff, and the upshot was, we're doing social media for UKPI for a very short time, and being involved in the sponsorship family, which is all UKPI. You know, I started to feel uncomfortable, and I thought, look, this feels I'm not calling these guys corrupt, right? Because they do a lot of great work, but there were certain positions that were being reserved for people in the sponsorship family. And it wasn't that, actually. If I'm looking at it now and being completely honest, I just felt very frustrated at the lack of progress, and I would also feel that people were going, region. That's the top, that's the pinnacle. And I'd hear guys say, if I could get on the world board, or, you know, that would be, you know, I would just be thinking, God, these guys are decades and decades clean. And I'm not really feeling this. And what I started to do was recoil and retreat and start to look at my program, look at my sponsor, look at the relationship. And one of the things I've been told is, Paul, when you take on a position, that's for a year, and you never give up that position. And the reason you never give it up, and I think this best illustrates the kind of the crowd that I got in with to try and get you guys to accept me and to try and sound good in meetings. This illustrates it best. The reason you never renege on a 1 year commitment is because when you go for a future position in, you know, in Europe or a region, you'll be asked if you've ever given up on a position, and it could lead to you not getting the even bigger position that you want to go for. That illustrates kind of the path that I was going down. Right. So it says in the literature, you know, like what I said with you guys before, that we try and keep our meetings newcomer focused. And what I thought was, how can we empower the groups here? How can we empower the members? So let's start with my home group. Let's put all my energy into there. Let's see what we can do. And it, we had the same story going in. And this might start to sound like a bit of a moan, but it's been a big learning of mine that we can really empower ourselves as members and as groups. And I felt a little bit disempowered by a couple of experiences, and I felt disempowered by the service structure as it was set up. I think you guys at Higna have really bucked the trend, you know, and as I said, we've looked to you. So we start as a group, we start doing things like PR and PI as a group. We start fundraising. People were losing their shit. Like, you can't do that. I'm like, well, I think, you know, every time you find a line in a tradition which tells me why I can't do it, like, for instance, it will divert you from your primary purpose. I think if you look at our meeting, the message is being carried pretty bloody effectively. And it also says in tradition 4 that we can do A, B and C. So I was finding, I was starting to kind of fight back and get quite quite passionate about what we're, the work we're doing with the newcomer. So we were doing, in the last couple of years, we've done phone boxes, the old style phone boxes, where we have put the helpline number on phone boxes. So I shared this with Steve the other day. We've done the electronic billboards. Where we, as a group, Clean and Serene at 12:15 in Aberdeen, we are looking to do a PI project in Lagos in Nigeria. Because this is the beautiful thing, we started doing a treatment centre meeting on a Monday night. It was an IP17 meeting. That's for those in treatment, one of our information pamphlets. And what we were doing was we were attracting treatment centres from all over the world. And we'd partnered up with some guys in Johannesburg. And at one time, I think there was 220 guys on the screen in one treatment centre there. And it was the most powerful, powerful thing. And I started to learn, wow, I really, really need the newcomer more than, this isn't a hierarchy. This isn't a kind of like, we're looking down on you and I do this kind of service. So that means we're all addicts of equal status. I can't remember the quote, someone can tell me later. We're all addicts of equal status, freely helping, or helping one another freely. It's something like that. And when I started to get into that mindset, right, okay, how can we keep the meetings? How can we keep the service more newcomer focused? My recovery just really started changing dramatically. So we do the IP17 meeting. We've been doing that for a year. There's one treatment centre, I won't name it. It's in the west coast of Glasgow, and it's turned out to be like a feeder system for NA. Now, we know for years and years and years, of course, treatment centres have put their addicts to NA. But on this platform, they've come every week for more than a year to this meeting, speaker meeting, and we've seen them pick up 6 months, 9 months, 1 year. And wow, it's, you know, there's that line in tradition 1 about being moved by the miracle when we share this gift. It just blows my mind. This morning, I had seven WhatsApp messages from guys from that treatment centre who get their phones at the weekend and who are all getting home to see their families this weekend. They're reconnecting with kids, they're reconnecting with grandkids. And it's such a gift that those guys get in touch with me on a weekend or phone me on a weekend. I've actually ended up sponsoring one of them, which is great. And I'm really the thing about sponsorship, which is because I was just like, I don't know how guys sponsor. I don't know how you do it. It must be so taxing. I really was quite wary of it. And I mean, the best time is God's time, isn't it? And this particular chap came along, asked me to sponsor him, and I was finally ready, I think, to do it because of the way I was now being sponsored. And if we can talk about that for a little minute, my sponsor is in Melbourne. I mean, he likes me to keep his anonymity. He doesn't even really like me calling him a sponsor because it's he wants to keep it very equal and very democratic and like a partnership. And he's introduced me to the line number basic text. So the premise of this is, we've been doing our step work through the basic text. We do it every single day, which has been steep learning curve as well, because it's like bloody hell, I wish you'd just give me a day off. And then the more I read, and the more we did it, and the more I did it with other addicts read together, the more it fanned the flames for me, and I really wanted to do more of it. So if anyone doesn't know what the line numbered basic text is, we have a line numbered basic text where every single line is numbered. Last week, actually 2 weeks ago, we just started a line numbered reading group, study group on a Sunday morning at 10 a.m. from our area. It's called We Are the Basic Text. And the way it works is we come in, we say a prayer, and we turn to the literature and whatever it is we're reading. I don't know. In the We Are the Basic Text group, we read the first four chapters and we break it down word by word, line by line, and we do a couple of paragraphs, and then we haven't got to the discussion portion yet, but we all share back on it for 4 minutes. And it really brings it to life. The premise is that we're doing this, doing my sponsor, we are activating all the steps. So the big change for me was where I was previously being sponsored, it felt like I was being given assignments, and it was I was felt like I was being told what to do, and I was coming back with my step four or whatever it was 3 months later, and oh, you know, you hear everyone, I've been procrastinating, I've been stuck on a step four for 3 months, and then I'd be hoping that my sponsor at the time was going to give me marks out of 10. And when he did say, Paul, you've been really honest there, that's great work, suddenly I was sticking my chest out. We've kind of eradicated that kind of hierarchy way of doing it with the new guy, where we read as equals, we read a line. Then I read a line, then he reads a line, then I read a line, then he reads a line, and then we share on the lines that kind of stand out for us. The premise is that every line of our basic text is a spiritual text. Every line is group conscience. Every line has been prayed over, and we pay the respect to the program and the text by studying it in that way. And it's been a game changer for me. And as I say, I do it every day now. And what I was encouraged to do, because there's that thing where enforced morality, doesn't it? It lacks the power when we choose to take that path ourselves. And I just had to be introduced to this way of working. So the idea is that we're activating all the steps. You know, we're in this meeting now, right? We're asking for help. That's another thing. I've had to change my language. Rather than present to you as the guy that knows it all, every single day I will actually say the words, can you help me, to a newcomer? Can you help me read? You know, and that inversion, that asking for help, there's my step one right there. There's my admission right there. There's my surrender to what I suffer from. Because, right, the drugs are off the table now. You know, the drugs have been off the table for a couple of years. What is it I'm using today? You know, because I can be just as unmanageable. around resentment, self-righteousness, taking your inventory, anger, you know, ego, large and dominant. You know, so this is, what am I using today? It's one of my inventory questions. So the idea is that we're in a meeting now, we're activating all the steps, we're turning to the literature, we're sharing inventory. I'm sharing inventory with you now. You know, I had to learn that my step four never ends. You know, that I do daily inventory, and four is just a continuation, 10 is just a continuation of four. I'm addressing my defects. Why did I do that? How was my disease active today? I used to be thinking like, you know, what does my recovery look like today? I think I'm much more interested in what did my disease look like today? Was I acting out? Was my thinking getting unmanageable in any area? Because my experience, guys, shows me the one time where I did get 9 months clean. One time I did get 9 months clean, I was off my rocker with resentment and lust and anger and, you know, let's find this woman and make her my higher power, you know. So it's only through understanding and application that this works. So I'm working, I'm focusing on the application, but I really need to get to grips with the understanding of this. My step eight never ends. You know, I've got a living step eight list that's in my phone that I add people to. You know, if I'm sitting slaughtering you in a meeting in my head and thinking, what about, I actually got humiliated the other day. Actually, I was listening to a girl share in a meeting and it was bonkers. You know, I was like, I'm going to fucking kill this one. I'm going to kill that one. Boom, boom, boom. Off her rocker. And I was judging because, you know, my disease is negative and antisocial. So I'm judging, that's my default. I start to think, God, Paul, if there was a recording of some of the stuff you'd been bloody sharing in meetings over the years, you know, you'd be it would be like a comedy reel or something. So and then I start going to this newcomer meeting, you know, one of these kind of really unmanageable meetings that kind of really fucks with my control issues, because, you know, because we get so many bombers and so many trolls in the Zoom meetings, we have to be on it. We have to keep people muted. You know, we have to keep the chat closed sometime. We have to be controlling. So when I go into one of these meetings, it's just like a riot. And then you've got a using addict chairing the meeting. And I'm there with my sponsor, who, as I say, is in Melbourne. And I'm starting to feel a bit ashamed, or somehow shame, or oh no, God, what's he going to think coming to this meeting? And I say to him, also, I was kind of apologising for the meeting. I'm really sorry about this. And he said, what do you mean? I said, well, there's a using addict chairing the meeting. And he said, well, I'm a using addict, you know. And I got what he meant, and I actually felt shame at that moment. And it's like, Paul, you really need to keep focused on what we're doing. You know, I can't get too far ahead of myself, get too far away from what we're doing. So I don't know, I think I'm coming up for time, Steve. I think I've probably been sharing for 40 minutes, which must be like a Guinness Book of Records job, but I'll maybe start to wind down. I have a gift, I owe a debt of gratitude to any that I could never repay, right? So still not working, which allows me to focus on my recovery, allows me to focus on the nature of this kind of self-centered fear. A lot, you know, during inventory, I like to reverse engineer the exact nature, you know, it's usually a defect, right, that I'm acting out on. So what is the defect? Well, let's take it back another notch. Well, it's self-centered fear usually, and then let's take it back again, and it's the disease of addiction. So I'm doing a lot of writing, I'm doing a lot of reading. By the way, I must say, if there's anyone on this meeting who's interested in helping me read, I think the drill now is, if we meet a newcomer, I'll say, can you help me read step one, or can we start with a symbol, or what do you want to do? Because that's the beautiful thing with this two-way partnership, or this partnership that I'm in, that I'm never told, right, you're working this tradition, or you're reading this step, or go off and write this. it's just so equal. It's like, what would you like to do? I can make some suggestions. We could read step eight. I was on an eight recently, and what we did the line numbered basic text. We called it the deep rinse. Then we did the reading of it works how and why, and then we did the step working guide. Before I even made my list. The literature is just the gift that just keeps on giving. It really does, you know. So yeah, I'm so grateful. We do the first Monday of every month at Clean and Serene. We do a basic text workshop. So that's done with the aforementioned friend who's been doing these basic text workshops for years. We did it at the London Convention. What I'm finding is that when newcomers are introduced to NA and introduced to this kind of language and this program, and introduced to if we can, you know, the attraction rather than promotion thing that people often misunderstand relates to public relations and wonder why we're doing it. When we live by example and show this is what we're doing, we study this stuff like our life depends on it, because it does, and we shred this basic text and we love it. And it's, you know, that old joke about if you want to hide a tenner from an addict, stick it inside the basic text. That no longer stands, you know, because really there's people out there dying. We lost another couple last week from this area, you know, people that had 3 or 4 years clean time. You know, so that's what's waiting for me. That's what shows me that 9 months where I was crazy. I thought, just when my thoughts were so unmanageable, I thought, go back to what I know best and use. And I was out there for 2 or 3 years and almost never made it back. So yes, thank you for asking me to share. I wish I had something more profound to end on, but I've just shared from the heart, guys, and I hope I've reached someone. And again, if MD wants to connect and read or join the study group, you know, I'm sure Steve can facilitate that. So thank you, Steve. I'm very grateful. Be clean.
Thank you, Paul. That was lovely.
Thank you so much. Really glad you're here.
Thank you,
Thank you,
Paul.
Paul.
Good man. Good man. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Paul. That was awesome. Loads and loads and loads of identification, not the details, but the stuff. Wow. Just really appreciate you coming along and sharing what you shared tonight. Funny enough, I've actually just started that process with my